and, you know, the wars, are they going to be what determines this election?
Well, they're going to be big factors, obviously. But maybe the biggest question for me that will determine the presidential election is which matters more, frustrations with how Biden is doing his job and with his age, or the negative views of Trump. Most voters say Biden is too old to be president and they give him low approval ratings. But in many surveys, they like Trump even less. You know, and I'd expect Democrats to spend millions of dollars reminding voters what it is they don't like about Trump and expect them to use abortion rights again as a motivator to get voters to the polls.
So we've also seen several third-party candidates jump into this race. How do you think they'll affect this?
Yeah, I think they're going to be a huge wild card. I mean, something that keeps Democratic strategists who I talk to up at night. You know, you have people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Jill Stein, Cornel West. No one is quite sure how any of them will factor in, but Trump has a pretty firm base of supporters. So if you start there, Democrats worry that disaffected voters who would have chosen Biden over Trump would vote potentially for one of those others and open up a path for Trump back to the White House. Those candidates and whether they gain real support could be something key to watch here.
That's NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
You're welcome.
As the new year begins, Israel's war in Gaza is nearing its three-month mark. President Biden's request for an aid package that includes some $14 billion for Israel is stalled in Congress. The administration has now twice bypassed Congress to approve emergency weapon sales to Israel. My colleague Michelle Martin asked two guests on different sides of the issue whether or how America's support for Israel's war serves U.S. interests. They are Youssef Munayer, head of the Palestine-Israel program at the Arab Center think tank, and Jonathan Schanzer, senior vice president for research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. That's a think tank founded after 9/11 that focuses on threats to U.S. national security. Here's Schanzer.
The first thing to remember here is that Hamas is part of a network of Iran-backed terrorist organizations. So that includes Hezbollah, it includes the Houthis, the Shiite militias that are based in Iraq and Syria that have attacked U.S. forces more than 100 times since October 17th. And if our goal ultimately is to weaken this Iranian axis that they have built up over time and to weaken Iran's influence on the Middle East, Hamas is actually a good place to start.
Mr. Munayer, what about you? Do you think that this serves U.S. interests?
When it comes to the continued support for this war on Gaza, it's very clear that it doesn't serve U.S. interests. The United States has had to move military assets into the region, which of course comes at a cost, increases the cost to the U.S. taxpayer, which is paying for all of this military maneuvering on the American side and also paying for a lot of the support to Israel. Also, there's a disruption in shipping in the Red Sea, which has a bigger impact on the global economy. On the diplomatic front, the United States is isolated when it comes to its allies, who at this point have all called for a ceasefire. Basically, all NATO allies are there already. The United States is not.
Is there a way that the U.S. could be supporting Israel without supporting the way this war is being conducted right now?
U.S. support for Israel does serve certain American interests, particularly when it comes to extending American power throughout the region. Of course, there are also costs associated with this.
Okay, so Mr. Schanzer, can you take up that point?
Look, I think the real way that the United States can solve all of this, and remarkably, it's just not been discussed, is to be leaning on Hamas's patrons to force a surrender of this terrorist organization, to force it to lay down its arms and to leave the Gaza Strip. And here I'm talking about the primary patron of Iran, but also countries like Qatar, Turkey, even Malaysia, Algeria. I don't think anyone wants to see this war continue. Why the U.S. has not used that leverage up until now is really shocking to me.
Why do you think they haven't?
I think that the U.S. is fearful of a broader clash with Iran. Number two, I think we are dealing with two other primary patrons. The Qataris have our largest airbase in the Middle East, and they have been patrons of Hamas. The same with the Turks. These are NATO allies with a major base in central Turkey, and we now have this challenge of trying to confront them. I don't see this as a question of whether to support Israel. This is a question of whether we should be continuing to have these very inconvenient relationships with what I would call frenemies, countries that purport to be American allies while also supporting terrorist groups around the region.
What about Mr. Munayyer's point about what seems to be the U.S.'s growing isolation, even among NATO allies?
Hamas carried out a massacre of 1,200 people. It raped women. It killed children. It kidnapped 240 people. The Israelis have every right to respond. They do not want to see civilian casualties. They don't want to see IDF casualties. But this is, after all, a war. It's a war that no one in Israel wants to continue. They want Hamas gone so that they can go back to quiet. And I think that is lost on many in America. I think it's lost on many in Europe.
So, Mr. Munayyer, your thoughts about how this is affecting the way America is seen around the world?
For many, it's just further confirming something that they have long thought about the United States, and that's that when it talks about things like values and democracy and human rights, that these are empty words. You know, this isn't just about people responding to protests in the street. This is about people being fundamentally disturbed and horrified by the reality that they're seeing on the ground.
If you had the ear of the administration, what would you advise them to do at this point?
Well, we need to bring an immediate end to this war, not just because of what it is doing to the civilian population on the ground who had nothing to do with October 7th, but also because it is completely counterproductive to the idea of peace. And if the options that are presented to Palestinians are perpetual apartheid, which has been the policies of this government in Israel, supported by the United States, or even worse, genocide or armed resistance, they're going to continue to support the latter. So if the idea is to try to get rid of Hamas, the way that Israel is going about it is doing the exact opposite thing.
Both of you who have worked in this area for such a long time, both of you have, you know, relationships with people in the region. Do you mind if I just ask each of you, how are you sitting with this, and what do you see as your role at a time like this?
Well, it's been exhausting, you know, mentally, physically. It's been horrific to watch. And the challenge that I have been really just, I've had a hard time getting my head wrapped around is the disconnect between the way in which Israelis are processing this, Palestinians are processing this, folks in the Arab world are trying to process this, and then, of course, those here in the United States. There are very, very different narratives. And trying to align them right now seems to be the greatest challenge, and I think really requires the most amount of effort from me and from others that are trying to look for constructive exits from this war.
What about you, Mr. Munayyer?
It's extremely difficult and exhausting. And at the same time, on a personal level, with many family connections in Gaza, it's a terrifying time. We know several people who have been killed and many others who are starving now.
That's Yusuf Munayyer. He's head of the Palestine-Israel program at the Arab Center. And Jonathan Schenzer is senior vice president for research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. Thank you both so much for talking about this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad you're starting the new year with us at 8:19 on this Monday. Well, because the calendar changed, it's now 2024. There are some things that are hitting the public domain, including the first version of Mickey Mouse from the 1928 short Steamboat Willie. What does that mean for Disney, and are we going to end up seeing some new interpretations of it now that it's in the public domain? That's still to come on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Celebrate traditions old and new this holiday season with special programs all this month. Hi, I'm Sarah Ashworth, director of WPR. Find beautiful music, friendly conversation, and engaging entertainment to keep you company at home, at work, and on the go.
Explore the full schedule of seasonal programs at WPR.org/holidays. And thanks for listening.
News from around the state and around the world, conversations about topics big and small, classical, folk, and international music. You hear it all on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's possible thanks to the support of our members. Find out more at WPR.org.
Support for WGTD comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Benefit specialists help navigate Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other benefit programs. Their services are free and confidential. Call 262-605-6646 for more info.
For your New Year's Day forecast, the chance for a few flurries in the south just to start the day. Things clearing up later on this morning. Otherwise, a mix of sunshine and clouds today with highs in the 20s and 30s. More of the same expected tomorrow. Mix of sunshine and clouds, highs in the 20s and 30s, but a chance for some flurries in the northern half of the state. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Workday. With AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to help teams stay agile. Workday, the finance and HR system for a changing world. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Today marks the move of copyrighted works from 1928 into the public domain. Among those is an early Walt Disney movie that features the first appearance of Mickey Mouse. NPR's Netta Ulubi fills us in on the status of a beloved cultural icon.
Mickey Mouse, in the 1928 short Steamboat Willie, is not much like Mickey today. He's rough, more of a rascal, says a former Disney Imagineer.
Very flat, very black and white.
Ryan Harmon says this early iteration of Mickey Mouse is honestly kind of gnarly. He spends the movie forcing barnyard animals into being unwilling musical instruments. This Mickey Mouse is also rooted in blackface minstrel humor that was widespread a century ago. But Mickey has changed with the times.
You know, he's evolved so much and become more 3D and colorful.
And cuddly and corporate. Now, let's be clear. Mickey Mouse, as a character, is not going into the public domain, says communications professor Kembru McLeod.
What is going into the public domain is this particular appearance in this particular film.
That means people can creatively reuse only the Mickey from Steamboat Willie, not the Mickey Mouse in the movie Fantasia from 1940.
Mr. Stokowski! Mr. Stokowski!
Or the one in kids' shows on Disney Plus today.
It's the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse!
All those newer Mickey Mouse's mice remain under copyright. You can copyright characters, movies, books, but guess what? Mickey Mouse is also a trademark. Trademarks protect brands, logos, names.
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E.
That's me!
And of course, trademark law has no end.
Law professor Ruth Okedigi says Disney and other corporations use trademarks to extend control over intellectual property. Now, people should still be able to do things like use clips of Steamboat Willie in art projects, or maybe sell t-shirts with a frame from the movie.
But if those things infringe upon the trademark, or if they threaten to dilute the trademark because of the way it's used,
then Disney can use the law to assert its ownership. This could keep people from making, for example, a slasher movie with Mickey Mouse, which someone actually did when Winnie the Pooh went into the public domain last year.
You also just can't call your restaurant Mickey Mouse on January 1st. You know, you can't say, I'm the Mickey Mouse restaurant. That would be a clear trademark violation.
Yeah, Disney is just famous for being litigious.
Communications professor Kimberly McLeod.
The Disney Corporation famously sent a cease and desist letter to a Florida daycare that had painted some of its characters on its walls.
But over the past few decades, Disney's turned from filing lots of copyright and trademark-related lawsuits to focusing on online piracy. McLeod doubts Disney will bother to spend legal capital on an old cartoon from 1928. The company even put Steamboat Willie on YouTube for free.
There are so many ironies.
The ironies around Steamboat Willie, McLeod says, are that that movie is based on another copyrighted film from the era, a hit called Steamboat Bill. And this song you can hear was in the public domain. We need to borrow and put our own spin on what's happening in the cultural conversation, he says. That's how art and technology progress. Public domain makes that possible. Neda Ulibi, NPR News.
So that early version of Mickey Mouse is not alone in its release from the copyright cage. Jennifer Jenkins runs the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School. And every year, she writes about some of the original works that lose legal protection.
In 1928, we were in the midst of a transitional period for cinema. We were at the end of the silent film era. And at the time, talkies with synchronized sound were a technological marvel, including a film that apparently features singing cowboys.
I'm half crazy, all for the love of you.
It's called In Old Arizona.
And it's worth noting here that Old Arizona had only achieved statehood about 16 years before this Western was released. In literature, Jenkins points to three titles headed to the public domain with familiar themes.
You know, right now we're in the midst of cultural battles about the extent to which things like gender identity are or should be viewed as immutable. Looking back into history this year at 1928, we find exactly the same concerns and debates, and even the same attempts to ban or censor certain themes and certain points of view.
Such as a book that's inspired multiple film adaptations.
D.H. Lawrence's Lady Chatterley's Lover, which explores lust and class division and which was famously banned as obscene.
Another explores lesbian love, Radcliffe Hall's The Well of Loneliness.
And one of my favorite books is an English major, Virginia Woolf's Orlando, which features a fascinating character who experiences life as both a man and then a woman.
All over the course of 300 years of British literary history.
And Woolf writes, in every human being, a vacillation from one sex to the other takes place. And often it is only the clothes that keep the male or female likeness, while underneath the sex is the very opposite of what it is above. And so here's an exploration of gender fluidity from almost 100 years ago that is still very much relevant today.
Other works heading into the public domain today reflect a unique movement in U.S. history.
In 1928, the Harlem Renaissance was in full swing. And this year, we are celebrating works such as Dark Princess by W.E.B. Du Bois and Home to Harlem by Claude McKay.
Plus, Louis Armstrong's Bo Kujak. While the Harlem Renaissance revealed Black excellence, Jenkins reminds us it was still a time of legally enforced segregation.
Many works from the era contain racial slurs, demeaning depictions, stereotypes. And at the time, Black artists were also subject to rampant exploitation. They were routinely excluded from copyright benefits and were denied both the recognition and compensation for their work that they deserved.
A complicated and fascinating time capsule. Public Domain Day 2024 is on the Duke Law School website.
When you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
This is NPR News.
In 2023, themes of girlhood were all the rage, from the Barbie movie to ballet flats.
Things feel sort of dour and morose and serious, and girlhood is sort of an obvious way to introduce some of that lightness back into our lives.
More on one of this year's pinkest trends on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30 today on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Good morning. Happy to have you with us for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio on this first day of 2024. It's 8:29 with news from NPR and WPR beginning in just seconds.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The president of Ukraine is pledging to boost production of weapons this year. In a New Year's address to the nation, Volodymyr Zelensky said his country will build at least 1 million drones. The BBC's James Waterhouse has more.
President Zelensky insisted that his country had become stronger in the face of Russia's full-scale invasion. Along with producing more weapons, he said Russia would see what our real wrath is with the first arrival of F-16 fighter jets. The Netherlands announced it would deliver 18 last week. Kyiv is hoping to manufacture drones, military equipment, and artillery shells in a process no doubt fueled by Western supplies beginning to stutter.
The BBC's James Waterhouse reporting. The Department of Justice is juggling several high-profile investigations. They include former President Donald Trump and President Biden. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports on how the probes will play out in the months ahead.
Two sources are telling me the investigation of Joe Biden for having classified material at his office and his home is close to an end. It's still sure to become a conversation point in the campaign. And as for Donald Trump, he's pleaded not guilty to two federal indictments in D.C. and Florida.
That's NPR's Carrie Johnson reporting. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. There are multiple lawsuits over PFAS contamination making their way through Wisconsin courts. Legal experts say the cases are complex and could take years to resolve. But in many cases, manufacturers of the potentially harmful chemicals have offered settlements worth millions. Philip Comella is an attorney who has worked extensively on PFAS cases. He says most do not require plaintiffs to prove a manufacturer knew that the chemicals were harmful.
It's strict liability, which means that if you produced a product and it causes harm, you don't have to know that it was going to cause injury.
Prolonged exposure to PFAS has been linked to increased risks for some cancers and lower fertility. In late November, the city of Wausau became the latest Wisconsin municipality to file suit. The city is suing dozens of manufacturers and insurance companies that it says are responsible for contaminating the community's water. A new study of birth records during the pandemic found that COVID-19 infections caused a spike in premature births. Hope Kerwin has more on the research from the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
UW-Madison sociology professor Jenna Nobles found that the preterm birth rate from 2020 to 2023 was more than 1 percentage point higher than normal. The biggest spike in early births happened in 2020, but Nobles says the rate returned to normal as more people got the COVID-19 vaccine. She says it's an important finding for pregnant people who are considering the vaccine or the latest booster.
It's not just that vaccines are safe and effective in pregnancy. It's also that avoiding vaccines can be very harmful, particularly in the context of emerging infections like COVID.
Like older adults and people who are immunocompromised, Noble says pregnant people are vulnerable to emerging viruses. She hopes the study will help inform how health providers and officials think about their response to future infectious diseases. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
In weather today, highs in the 20s and 30s across the state. A chance for a few flurries in the south to start, but things should eventually be clearing throughout the day. More of the same expected tomorrow, highs in the 20s and 30s, except a chance for some flurries in the northern part of the state. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Educators are rethinking how reading should be taught in schools. New research has highlighted flaws in decades-old methods. As a result, dozens of states have passed laws or implemented new policies related to evidence-based reading instruction. This comes at a time when two-thirds of children in the U.S. are struggling to read. So how are colleges and universities that train teachers responding? That's the question NPR's Alyssa Nadworny, with the help of a dozen member station reporters, has been asking. My colleague A. Martinez spoke with her about that.
So, Alyssa, what did you find? I mean, are teacher prep programs aligning with the science of reading?
So NPR and our member stations reached out to a dozen institutions with education schools. Many said they were constantly changing and updating their curriculum to match current research on reading. A recent study by the National Council on Teacher Quality that looked at 700 teacher training programs at universities found that too many programs weren't aligned with the research on how to teach kids to read. Here's Heather Pesky. She's the president of the organization that did that study.
Only about a quarter of the teachers who leave teacher preparation programs across our nation enter classrooms prepared to teach kids to read, aligned to the science and research on reading. While the rest of the teachers who've invested lots of money and lots of time in learning to teach enter classrooms unprepared.
One of the persistent strategies not backed by research is the cueing system. So that's where students rely on context and sentence structure to identify words they don't know. This method often downplays phonics and sounding out letters. And the study found that many teacher prep programs still were using that method.
Okay, so then how should we be teaching reading?
Well, research shows there are five core components of teaching reading, including phonics, vocabulary, and comprehension. I want you to listen in on a reading class at Oklahoma State University that member station reporter Beth Wallace of State Impact Oklahoma visited. And you're going to hear some really good examples of university students learning about syllables and sounds from their professor, Robin Fuchsa.
So the first one, the phoneme, that sound is b. So you're going to think about how your mouth is positioned and take some notes there. When you say buh, what does your mouth do? Buh. Everybody ready? We're determining how many sounds are in this word. So let's do the word map. What about peat?
Eat. Wow, Alyssa, that takes me back to when I was learning English in the first grade. When I got to the first grade. I mean, okay, so for the places who have changed the way they've trained their teachers, I mean, how did they do it?
Well, in many places, it was because politicians got involved or the state set new standards better aligned with the research. One example is in North Carolina, where the legislature passed a law mandating that curriculum be backed by the science of reading. They also evaluated universities in 2021 on how well they were doing at that. Brianna Atkinson from member station WUNC talked with faculty at several universities in North Carolina, and many said the changes have not been easy. Here's Gretchen Robinson, a professor and department chair at UNC Pembroke.
So it's taken some time to kind of get the buy-in. It's taken some time for faculty to kind of understand the changes and things.
You know, she said there have been faculty that have left who weren't on board with the new approaches, and so they've had to hire new faculty who are.
You know, Alyssa, despite all of the new research and the attention on reading, there's still fear at some universities that politicians are kind of getting involved, throwing their thumb in the pie there. So, I mean, did you hear from educators who felt wary of that?
We did. Yeah, we heard that a lot. Several states have passed laws to remove things like that cueing strategy we talked about. Florida is one of them. WUSF reporter Carrie Sheridan in Tampa Bay talked with Jennifer Jasinki Schneider about this. She's a professor of literacy studies in the College of Education at the University of South Florida. And she said USF is not changing their way of teaching reading because they've always taught phonics and incorporated, you know, those five pillars. But she really balked at the idea that politicians would get involved.
Legislating how we teach reading. No legislators, no collective group of legislators have the knowledge to do that.
And, you know, she's right. It can't just be politicians, but it is clear that many training programs need a push or at least a strong incentive to change. And look, the bottom line is too many kids in this country are not learning to read. The good news, of course, is that we have the tools and the science to be able to turn that around.
All right. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny covers higher education for NPR. Alyssa, thanks.
Thank you.
If you popped a cork last night as the clock struck midnight, then I hope you savored the taste, because the three grapes used to make almost all champagne could change beyond recognition within the next few decades. Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier are all at risk, according to new data from the firm Climate AI.
By 2050, we're looking at about 85% of the lands that we grow good wine grapes on actually no longer producing suitable wine grapes.
Jasmine Spies is the company's head of wine and events.
That doesn't mean necessarily that these grapes will go away, but we are noticing a very marked change in the tastes of these grapes due to a warming planet.
A hotter and drier climate means we have to say au revoir to that distinctive flavor from the Champagne region of France.
For instance, in a Chardonnay grape, what you're looking for in a cooler climate is generally a taste that's apple or a little citrusy, whereas in a warmer climate, the warmth can change the grape's qualities to be more like a tropical fruit or even banana-like.
A banana-flavored champagne? I don't think so. Now, climate scientists like Benjamin Cook have been watching all this for years.
Wine is kind of the canary in the coal mine for climate change impacts on agriculture, because so much of the character of wine is tied to the local climate.
Cook is with NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and published a paper on this back in 2020.
We're seeing pretty much all plants, including wine grapevines, start their life cycle in the growing season earlier and oftentimes finish up earlier. You basically ripen your fruit earlier and typically you harvest earlier.
And that means a different flavor.
There's a variety of characteristics of these grapes that depend on how fast and sometimes what time of year the grape ripens and matures. If it matures too quickly, the ratio of acidity and sugar might be different.
So Cook predicts that champagne as we know it will be no more.
We expect within the Champagne region itself, the characteristics of champagne are likely to change because these grapes are going to be responding to climate change.
But fear not, bubbly lovers. Jasmine Spies says other regions will be able to grow the grapes due to the warming climate. You just might not be able to call it champagne, which is a protected designation of origin.
Places like Belgium and the Netherlands and Sweden, they're experiencing positive effects of climate change as the planet is warming.
So we can drink to that at least. A champagne supernova in the sky. This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:42. Got about 18 minutes left in the show now and still lots more to get to. We're going to hear about a Southern California school district, rather. More than a year after they banned the teaching of critical race theory, some Temecula Valley Unified students say that it's resulted in more racism. That story is coming up still this hour on Wisconsin Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate New Year's Day with Barbara Streisand and listen back to our interview from November. We talked about her two Broadway shows and why she decided to never do another, how she learned the hard way that romance with your leading man can spell trouble, and we listen to some of her great recordings. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air tonight and each weeknight at 7 here on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Support comes from Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, offering personalized tutoring from certified teachers that's designed to inspire. Convenient scheduling and affordable hourly rates. Explore the options, search Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, or call 262-694-6286.
At 8:44, here's what's happening in news. Japan has issued tsunami warnings for some parts of its country after a 7.6 magnitude earthquake and several powerful aftershocks hit the area. Lower-level tsunami warnings have been issued for other parts of Japan as well. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is resisting international calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, instead saying over the weekend that the war against Hamas will likely last, quote, for several more months. A multi-state kidnapping ended safely in Wisconsin over the weekend. An 11-year-old child who was abducted from Indiana was found safely in Iowa County. And flags across Wisconsin still flying at half staff in honor of former Senator Herb Kohl, who passed away at the age of 88. Flags will remain at half staff until sunset on the day he's laid to rest. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure wildlife and wild lands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. Shikimia Pate was just 8 years old when she went missing from her home in Georgia on September 4th, 1998. She has not been seen or heard from since. As NPR's Jonathan Franklin reports, her family's still hoping for answers more than 25 years later.
It's been over 2 decades since Veronica Pate last saw her daughter, Shikimia Pate. But she says she hasn't given up hope on finding her.
She's been missing 25 years, but I still feel that she's alive out there.
On the day she disappeared, Shy Shy, as her friends and family called her, was playing outside of the front porch of her family's home in Unadilla, Georgia, a town roughly 45 miles outside of Macon. Her older sister left to fill her car with gas before the family went to a local high school football game later that night. But when her sister returned home, she realized that Shy Shy was gone. At first, the family believed Shy Shy had gone ahead to the football game with a friend. But as night started to fall, Veronica says the family's panic began to set in.
We got kind of scared because that was something we had never been used to.
In the months after Shy Shy vanished, police and family members went from door to door across Unadilla, looking for any signs of her. Law enforcement from neighboring counties assisted with the initial search, while residents in the neighborhood where Shy Shy grew up opened their doors and helped the family try and locate her. But sadly, nothing ever came of it. Shikimia would have turned 34 on October 29th, and despite all the years that have passed, efforts to locate her are long from over.
Somebody out there knows something.
That's Randy Lambert, an investigator with the Dooley County Sheriff's Office, who has served as the lead investigator on this case since the very beginning. He tells me that his office, along with the Georgia Bureau of Investigations and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, continues to comb through old and new leads, hoping to make a break in the case. He says he hopes Shy Shy will return home to her family safely.
We have followed up on those, contacted these agencies to see what they've got.
Randy says that over the years, his office continues to receive several leads from across the state and even places as far away as Detroit. But so far, the leads have come up with no promising results.
I kindly feel it may be one person was involved in this.
In 2022, more than 546,000 people were reported missing in the United States. That's according to data from the National Crime Information Center. And while Black women and girls make up 7% of the U.S. population, they unfortunately make up roughly 20% of all missing person cases.
Until you have concrete information as to what happened to the missing individual, we cannot give up hope in finding them.
That's Natalie Wilson, the co-founder of the Black and Missing Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to bringing awareness to missing people of color. She says that time is critical in missing person cases, as the first 24 to 48 hours are the most important in the search. The longer one waits to file the initial police report, the more information in the search, such as forensics, can be lost. In Shy Shy's case, though, her friends and family quickly contacted authorities to begin the search for her that same day. And still, years later, investigators and national agencies continue to follow dozens of leads in the case, hoping that somebody will come forward with what happened to Shy Shy 25 years ago.
Shy Shy's family deserve answers as to what happened to her. She disappeared over 2 decades ago, but we continue to hold on to hope that they will get the answer that they deserve, and we hope that it's to bring her home safely.
After all these years, Veronica still hopes to reunite with her daughter, doing whatever it takes to bring her home.
Even if she's fine and she don't want to come back here, I just want that stamp saying she located, and I never gave up looking for her. And no matter how long it takes, I'm not going to stop searching for my daughter.
Jonathan Franklin, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
and this is Morning Edition on WPR. Glad you're with us and spending part of your New Year's morning with us. Thank you so much for being here. Got about 11 minutes left in the program now, and we're still going to hear that story out of Temecula Valley Unified, where students say that after critical race theory was banned, it's resulted in more racism, but it's not exactly just always out front. We'll hear that coming up in just a few minutes on WPR.
Support comes from the law offices of Frank J. Parise, specializing in criminal defense, traffic, and DUIs. 262-656-9906. The law offices of Frank J. Parise since 1985. Located in Kenosha at 7001 30th Avenue.
State organization of the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. In sports, the Green Bay Packers beat the Minnesota Vikings last night to keep their playoff hopes alive. The Packers will wrap up the regular season this upcoming Sunday against the Chicago Bears at 3:35. The game will air on CBS. In college football today, the playoffs with Alabama taking on Michigan and Texas playing Washington. The winners will meet in the championship game. Wisconsin Badgers have their final football game of the season at 11 this morning against LSU. And the Milwaukee Bucks take on the Indiana Pacers at home tonight. That one starts at 7. In weather, chance for a few flurries to start the day today, especially in the south, but things clearing by about mid-morning, with highs in the 20s and 30s today. More of the same tomorrow, mix of sunshine and clouds, highs in the 20s and 30s, but this time a chance for flurries in the northern part of the state. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz. It's been more than a year since the teaching of so-called critical race theory was banned in Temecula Valley Unified School District in Southern California. It was the first big action of a newly elected and deeply conservative majority on the school board. About 4% of the district's students are Black. Many have spent the last year reckoning with what it means to feel safe in a place that they say is trying to deny the existence of systemic racism. NPR's Sandhya Dirk spent time with some of these students and brings us this story.
Diane Cox is a beloved high school teacher. She's taught at Chaparral High in Temecula for decades, and she thinks to understand what's happening in Temecula, you need to hear from students, which is why on a Tuesday evening in late August, her kitchen is full of teenagers and their parents, some of whom were also her students.
It just so happens that Shayla was one of those students.
20 years ago, Shayla Anderson was a founding member of the Black Student Union that Mrs. Cox helped create on campus.
Now her daughter is fighting the same fight.
Shayla says when her daughter, Brooklyn, entered high school, she told her,
"You're going to be okay. Just find Miss Cox."
And that's exactly what Brooklyn did. She's now part of the same Black Student Union her mom helped found. Last year, Brooklyn was central in organizing student walkouts after the school district banned what they call critical race theory.
And it's not a ban on CRT, it's a ban on talking about race and a ban on learning about race and racism.
Like in many places across the country, the ban doesn't totally seem to understand what CRT actually is. The school board majority has said it's a divisive racist theory that holds that the most important thing about you is your race. But that's not actually what CRT is. Really, it's a complex legal theory that helps to describe how racism becomes embedded into the practice of law and our legal system, and isn't really taught outside of law schools. But here are some specific things the board did ban. You can't teach that racism is about power. Understanding power as a component of racism, that's banned now. You can't teach that, quote, racism is ordinary, the usual way society does business.
All of it is just to silence people about racism and talking about how racism is a fundamental part of how society works. That's just the truth. But they want to make that seem like it's a radical ideology, and it's really not.
Another student sitting around the table, Genesis Kokoa, says if the goal was to silence folks, it's working.
They never told the teachers what they could or could not say, so everyone was scared to talk.
Scared to talk about the roots of racism, but not scared to be racist, says Christian Adams, another student.
And I've experienced racism my entire life. Like, I've had bad experience with this stuff since I was 2 years old. But at the same time, it was always hidden. Now, people are upfront about it. People like to joke about being racist. Even people that aren't actually racist, they're like, yeah. Oh, yeah, they like to act like it's funny.
Sitting next to him and nodding is fellow student Kira Johnson.
These white kids who will be like, I have black friends, so like they're my slaves. Like, it's cool.
Kira says some of their black peers do racist things too.
You see literal black kids Nazi salute in the middle of class.
The teens talk about why they think this is happening. And then Diane Cox's daughter, Raven, now a college student in San Diego, she's been sitting off to the side, she steps up towards the table.
As like a weird, nerdy black kid, I couldn't really get along with my other black peers.
She says to fit in, she found herself going along with some racist jokes.
And it worked for me, but at what cost? Because now I have a bunch of like Asian and non-black friends calling me the N-word and like saying the N-word and saying like really racist, bigoted stuff because I think it's funny.
All of the teenagers sitting around the table at Mrs. Cox's house tell me the school board's ban has made this racism worse, more permitted, more pervasive. The kids say they don't feel safe. They're scared. Brooklyn says she's been scared to go to school board meetings. She says black people, people who oppose the board's agenda, they get kicked out of those meetings.
My mom got escorted out by the police, and I did not feel like safe.
Last year, Proud Boys and Three Percenters, extremist anti-government groups often affiliated or associated with racism and white supremacy, also showed up at some of those meetings. There's other fears, too. Here's Kiara Johnson again.
I'm scared about the English teachers, because they're the ones who are bringing in these books about diversity, about LGBTQ, about people of color.
Genesis Kakoa says she's afraid of losing the clubs like Black Student Union.
Especially in a predominantly white town, black children and children of color need communities where they can come together.
And that's when Diane Cox, always a little bit in teacher mode, chimes in. They can't do that, she says. It's against the state's laws.
So don't operate out of fear.
I'm not operating out of fear.
But Genesis says
they're not supposed to be getting rid of curriculum about black and brown students or black and brown history or gay history, but they're still trying to find a way to do it.
They're doing it anyway, and that's the problem.
Sitting on the couch behind her, Genesis's mom, Brandy Kakoa, speaks up.
It's deep-rooted here. Temecula has deep-rooted racism. I went to high school here. I know how it works. I was here when the skinheads was all the way live. They was letting them walk around with swastikas around their neck.
Back then, this part of the world was open neo-Nazi territory. The town next door was the home of the KKK's Grand Dragon. But it wasn't just rogue racists. It was the schools too, says Shayla. Shayla's Brooklyn's mother. She says when she moved to Temecula in middle school, schools used tracks. That's a method of grouping students by perceived intelligence and ability.
I noticed that all the black kids and the brown kids were on D track and C track, and the white kids were on A and B track. Mm-hmm. We noticed that they segregated us. The district did that.
It was hard being a black teenager back then in Temecula, she says. Genesis says she can relate.
And I don't think we should be able to relate because you guys have already done that. You guys, things should have changed already, and we're regressing with the CRT ban. Why is it getting worse? My mom was telling me about how when she went to school, like kids, sure, maybe they'd say the N-word, but also they would get checked. But if I check a white person for saying the N-word, I'll get made fun of. I get made fun of for being an activist by my own peers.
All of these students say racism is thriving in Temecula. You can tell teachers not to talk about it, but that doesn't make it go away. In fact, they say it's exactly the opposite. Sandhya Dirks, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rob Schmitz.
And I'm Alex Crow. Thanks for spending part of your New Year's morning with us for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. News from NPR and WPR on the way.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from many local arts groups and creators. Money spent locally on handcrafted gifts stays in the community and helps provide local artists and craftspeople with opportunities to achieve their dreams.
Support comes from Offsite, providing co-managed and fully managed IT solutions to help their clients navigate the complexity of running operations across multiple data centers, cloud platforms, and software applications. Visit off-site.com/radio. You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and